Okay, so you're in law school, right? You've probably come across trademark infringement.
Yeah, for sure.
The whole idea is to prevent consumers from getting confused about what they're buying.
Absolutely, like making sure people don't accidentally pick up the wrong brand thinking it's something else.
Right, exactly. But have you ever thought about how a brand's strength can be weakened even when there's no outright confusion?
Interesting. Like in a less obvious way.
That's where trademark dilution comes in. And today we're going to take a deep dive into a case that really changed the game. Levi Strauss v. Abercrombie and Fitch. This one's a real head scratcher when it comes to trademark dilution.
I'm all ears. Sounds like it's not as straightforward as just stopping someone from slapping a Nike swoosh on a knockoff shoe.
Not at all. So what we're dealing with here isn't about whether someone might grab a pair of Abercrombie jeans thinking they're Levi's.
Got it.
It's more about this idea that if you use a mark that's too similar to a famous one, you can slowly chip away at its distinctiveness.
Like how it stands out, how it makes you think of that specific brand.
Exactly. Like imagine a musical note, right? If you keep hearing a slightly off-key version of it, the original note starts to lose its clarity, its impact.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right. So let's get into the details of this case, the nitty-gritty.
Okay, let's hear it.
So we've got two back pocket stitching designs at the center of this whole legal battle.
Okay.
First, there's Levi's iconic arcuate stitching. You know, those two elegant curves that have been their trademark on denim since like 1873. I mean, they've got federal trademark registrations for this design, so it's pretty well established, legally speaking.
Yeah, you see those stitches and you immediately think Levi's. It's like ingrained in their brand.
Absolutely. Then in 2006, Abercrombie and Fitch comes along and introduces their rule design. How would you picture this one?
Let me see.
Think of it as two arches, but kind of flattened out, less prominent. And instead of just meeting in the middle, they're connected by a little loop, almost like a sideways figure eight.
I've seen that. A little dipsy doodle is what the court called it.
Yeah, that's the one. So it's not exactly the same as the arcuate, but Levi's argued it was still way too close for comfort. So in 2007, they slapped Abercrombie with a lawsuit, alleging both the classic trademark infringement, you know, the potential for confusing customers,
Right.
and the big one for our discussion today, trademark dilution.
Okay, so we're focusing on the dilution part here. So what happened with the lawsuit?
Well, here's where it gets interesting. Even though Levi's argued both points, the district court actually sided with Abercrombie on the dilution claim.
Wait, really? Why?
The key lies in the legal standard the court used at the time.
What was it?
For Abercrombie's design to be considered dilution of Levi's famous arcuate, it had to be, and I quote, "identical or nearly identical."
Identical or nearly identical? That seems pretty strict.
And it was. But this wasn't some random rule they pulled out of a hat. It was based on what the Ninth Circuit had been doing before some major changes happened in trademark law.
Makes sense. So the court was just following precedent.
Exactly. And there's another twist here, too. The district court proceedings involves an advisory jury. You know, the kind that advises the judge in a bench trial. Their opinion isn't binding.
Right.
And guess what? They also sided with Abercrombie. But this wasn't the end of the story.
Oh, I bet Levi's wasn't happy about that.
Not one bit. They appealed, took the case to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this, my friend, is where things get really, really interesting. Enter the Trademark Dilution Revision Act of 2006, the TDRA.
Ah, the TDRA. I remember studying this. It brought some huge changes to federal dilution law.
It sure did. So the Ninth Circuit had this big legal question in front of them. Did the TDRA, this new law, still require the marks to be practically indistinguishable, identical, or nearly identical for a claim of dilution by blurring to win?
That's a good question. It's like the TDRA threw a wrench into the whole thing.
Exactly. So what did the Ninth Circuit decide? Did they agree with the district court's take on the TDRA standard for dilution?
Nope, not at all.
Big reveal time.
They completely overturned the district court's ruling, specifically on that dilution claim. It was a major shift, really signaled a new way of looking at dilution. And get this, they did it by paying close attention to the actual words of the TDRA.
So they went straight to the source, no more relying on old interpretations.
Exactly. They wanted to see what the law actually said.
Okay, so let's break down their reasoning. What parts of the TDRA did they zoom in on?
They really focused on Section 1125C2B of Title 15 of the U.S. Code.
Got it.
This section lays out all the things courts should consider when deciding if a mark is likely to cause dilution by blurring. And one of those factors is, get ready for it, the degree of similarity between the mark or trade name and the famous mark. Does that phrase ring a bell?
Degree of similarity, huh? Wait a minute. There's no mention of identical or nearly identical there.
Bingo. The Ninth Circuit jumped right on that missing language. They said Congress specifically chose to use degree of similarity. They even pointed out that earlier drafts of the TDRA in the House of Representatives actually did include language requiring the marks to be the same or nearly identical.
Wow, so Congress had the chance to make it stricter, but chose not to.
Exactly. That stronger language was rejected before the TDRA was finalized. And to the Ninth Circuit, this meant that Congress wanted a different, less strict standard for dilution.
It's like a legal detective novel. They're digging into the legislative history, trying to understand the true intent behind the law.
That's a great way to put it. And think about it, it kind of makes sense. Congress might have realized that a famous mark could be weakened even by marks that aren't exact copies.
Right, like death by a thousand cuts. Even subtle similarities can add up over time and chip away at a brand's distinctiveness.
Exactly. So this shift in the law might have been about giving those famous trademarks more protection, recognizing that they could be harmed in ways that weren't addressed by the old, stricter standard.
So what did the Ninth Circuit say about the district court's reliance on that old, nearly identical rule?
They basically said, time to update your playbook. They made it clear that relying on that old precedent, the identical or nearly identical standard, just wasn't valid anymore when it came to federal dilution claims under the TDRA. They pointed out that the old standard was based on state dilution laws that came before the TDRA. The TDRA, being the newer, more specific federal law, basically overruled those old interpretations.
So the Ninth Circuit was like, listen, we have a federal law now. We can't be stuck in the past using state law standards.
Exactly. They basically reset the playing field for how dilution by blurring claims would be analyzed within the Ninth Circuit.
Okay, so let's talk impact. What did this ruling really change in the real world of trademarks? And what should law students, you know, future lawyers understand about all of this?
Well, the Ninth Circuit's decision was huge. It essentially lowered the bar for how similar marks had to be to claim dilution by blurring under federal law. Marks no longer needed to be practically identical. They just had to be sufficiently similar to potentially cause dilution. That's a big deal for anyone dealing with trademark law.
Sufficiently similar. So it's more about the overall impression, the potential for the famous mark to lose its distinctiveness rather than a pixel-by-pixel comparison.
That's a good way to put it. And it wasn't just a change within the Ninth Circuit. This decision actually helped resolve a disagreement between different circuit courts. You know, the Second Circuit, in cases like Starbucks v. Wolf's Den, had already taken a similar stance, saying that marks didn't need to be nearly identical for dilution.
So the Ninth Circuit's decision brought them more in line with what other courts were already doing.
Exactly. And this pushed back against a stricter view that the Fourth Circuit had. So it brought more consistency to how federal courts nationwide were interpreting this key part of dilution law.
More uniformity, less confusion for everyone involved.
Exactly. And ultimately, this ruling gave famous trademarks more protection under federal law. It gave brand owners more power to fight back against similar marks that could weaken their brand, even when consumers weren't likely to be confused about where the products were coming from.
So it shifted the focus away from just preventing confusion and more toward preserving the strength and uniqueness of well-known brands.
You got it. It made the whole analysis of dilution more nuanced. The degree of similarity between marks became super important, but it wasn't the only thing courts would look at.
Okay, going back to the Levi's case, you mentioned that Levi's had presented survey evidence in the district court.
Right.
They showed that something like 30% of consumers actually associated Abercrombie's design with Levi's. How does this sufficiently similar standard, this lower bar, change how we think about that kind of consumer perception evidence in dilution cases?
Well, survey evidence like that becomes even more crucial. Because the threshold for visual similarity is lower, you need more proof that consumers are making a connection, even if the marks aren't super similar visually.
So if you can show that people are still linking the two brands in their minds, it strengthens your case for dilution.
Exactly. It provides concrete evidence that the famous mark's distinctiveness is taking a hit, even if the copying isn't blatant.
Makes sense. And just to circle back to that advisory jury for a moment, what the Ninth Circuit did basically meant that the district court's reliance on the jury's finding, which was based on that outdated legal standard, wasn't the deciding factor in the appeal.
Right, because the district court used the wrong test. The whole analysis, including what the jury thought, was flawed in the eyes of the Ninth Circuit. It's important to note that the Ninth Circuit didn't actually say whether Abercrombie's design did dilute Levi's mark.
So they left that final decision for another day.
Exactly. They sent the case back to the district court, telling them to reevaluate the whole thing using the correct legal standard, you know, the TDRA, and how the Ninth Circuit interpreted it.
So for all our listeners out there who are on the path to becoming lawyers, what's the big takeaway from all this? What's the lesson from Levi Strauss v. Abercrombie and Fitch and how it changed the way we look at the TDRA?
I think the most important thing is that the Trademark Dilution Revision Act really changed the game for dilution law, especially at the federal level. That old identical or nearly identical rule from before the TDRA, it's out. This case really highlights how important it is to start any legal analysis with the actual words of the law.
Right. Don't get bogged down in old interpretations when the law itself has changed.
Right. Here, the specific language of the TDRA about degree of similarity and what Congress clearly intended when they chose those words trumped those older court decisions that were based on different legal ideas.
It's a reminder that the law is constantly evolving and lawyers need to stay on top of those changes.
Absolutely.
So here's something to think about. Think about all the logos and brand designs we see every single day. With this new standard, sufficiently similar, how might companies change the way they protect their brands from even subtle copying?
That's a really good question. It definitely raises some interesting challenges for trademark law in a world that's so saturated with visual branding.
Absolutely. It's a whole new ballgame.
It means companies need to be more sophisticated in how they protect their brands, understanding that dilution can happen in ways that are less obvious than straight-up copying.
It's a lot to think about. Well, that wraps up our deep dive for today. Thanks for joining us as we explored this landmark case and how it shaped the law of trademark dilution. It's been a fascinating discussion.
I agree. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Until next time.